Can I have a piece of music to set the scene? Something stirring, perhaps? Something proud? Oh, absolutely fantastic. I couldn't have chosen it better myself. Ireland's Call, the wonderful Stephen Mulrooney. I've got to hand it to that guy. Oh my God, it took so much courage to stand on that pitch and sing that song. And I guarantee you, you're all crying at home now. But at any rate, we go live to the Aviva Stadium, actually to the level crossing at the West Stand of the Aviva Stadium, because once again, the West Stand commands attention. It's where generations have stood shoulder to shoulder, united in green, in hope, in voice. And now it's wrapped in something a little different. A stunning series of wildlife murals that bring the spirit of the urban landscape to the heart of the action. A fox and a sparrowhawk. They're bold, they're beautiful, and they're a tribute to the character of the people that surround this place. Let's hand over to our team mural side now, as they say. Terry Flanagan, Niall Hatch, Dr. Richard Collins and Barry Kenny from Éireann Road Éireann. Good morning, boys.
Good morning.
Big crowd there, Terry?
Yes, there's myself and there's Barry and there's Niall and there's Richard, and we're down here at Lansdowne Road Station, and we're standing under this beautiful mural of a fox. It's looking down at us, and as the fox, just to paint a picture, so to speak, for the listeners, it's just at the entrance to the tunnel, for those of you who know this particular part of the line. And when you look into the tunnel, there is another mural, and if you look at it carefully, it's a cat that's actually running through the tunnel. It's running through a garden, and at the very, very far end, there's an urban hawk, a sparrow hawk, and it's looking down at the people, and it's spectacular. Barry, you're very welcome to the programme.
And there's our dart passing by just on cue with lovely train signs behind us.
It's a special day for you in Éireann Road Éireann.
Yeah, we have our newest train station opening, the 147th train station on the network at Woodbrook, that's between Bray and Shankill. So new dart stations, new community, there's over 2,000 new houses being developed there, so great to have a station up and running before people move in. A big break for people in Woodbrook.
Oh,
147, do you like that?
Well, that's very good if you're a snooker player in that. Yeah, it's a very, very scenic route, isn't it, when you're talking about going from Howth all the way down to Bray. I think Michael Portillo, didn't he have it on one of his programmes as well?
He did. It's I think for an urban rail system, you'd be hard pushed to get one as scenic. They call the section on the south side akin to the Bay of Naples. Having seen the Bay of Naples, I think it's prettier here. Yeah. And of course, then if you continue on beyond the Dart, the Dublin Rosslare line in full is absolutely spectacular, with coastal scenery, with inland waterway scenery all the way down to Rosslare.
And you're heading off today for the opening, yeah?
For Woodbrook, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's actually up and running already, but we have an official event and a community event later on in the morning.
Now, the reason why we're here today, Richard and Niall and myself, is because of this portrait behind us. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is, we think it's certainly the largest street art installation on our network, and probably one of the largest around. It's about 160 metres. And we put this in place between 2019 and 2021. There was a pandemic in the middle that delayed part two of it. But the vision behind it was, you know, street art should really reflect the environment and reflect the local area. And it's the urban wildlife that we wanted to represent here. And our own engineers, our own arts officer, worked on this, liaised with the artists, liaised with the Aviva as well, the Aviva Stadium and Dublin City Council. And so come up with this you know, really quite striking bookends of an urban fox and urban hawk, and then the black cat going through the urban environment, almost like those flicker page books we used to use play with as kids as the dart passes along under the West Stand.
Particularly as it's coming from Dublin out backwards out towards Bray, you can see that cat out the window. You can't actually walk beside it, but you can see it very well.
Exactly. And I suppose that's important, that it's not something that is there for the pedestrian. It is there for the Dart customer, because that's a restricted area. And in fact, when the works were being done to put the mural in place, we had to have them coincide with a weekend when we had line works, so that the darts were stopped, so that the artists could actually access the site and work safely and deliver what is, you know, we think a very striking and great addition, because, you know, it was simply the bare concrete back of a sports stadium stand before that.
It certainly brightens it up.
It does, completely. And, you know, we used to have the odd issue with trespass and vandalism in the area, and it's something that's helped with that as well in terms of prevention of that. But, I mean, you know, we have a lot of arts projects around the network, and very much, I think, environment and biodiversity is a part of that. And whereas, you know, we do something like in Kilcool, where we, are marking the Little Turn, we have the Turn to the Tide project there. Here you are reflecting that there's a lot of biodiversity in the urban area as well.
Have you plans for any more? If I was thinking of a station, the one I would think of would be Booterstown.
Booterstown, absolutely. We do have, I think, some information displays there, but would love to look at opportunities for that. Right now we are working on projects, a few projects across the country. Courtney Place in the inner city in Dublin. Castle Connell in rural Limerick. We're working in. We've had a recent installation in Newbridge. And looking at opportunities around the network, because, you know, we're part of people's community. So you want to be able to put in, I think, our projects that reflect that. And certainly, I think environment is a huge theme in what we do there.
Well, it's really a stunning piece that's here, because I was here about 20 minutes before you arrived, and watching people walk by, they'd never seen it before. They're looking up, and then they're looking into the tunnel, and they're trying to see what's that down the other end of the tunnel. They can't see the actual urban hawk,
yes,
but they can see the cat.
Yes.
And they can see the cat as if it's coming up towards them.
Totally.
So it's a really ingenious idea. Who came up with it? Was it the artist, or was it yourselves?
It was collaborative, very much. It was working, I suppose, with the artists, working, I suppose, kind of understanding the canvas there, as say our own arts officer Joanne Bissett would have been involved in that centrally as well, just to look at the themes, look at the ideas, and say, yeah, this works for here. We need a planning permission for this. It's obviously a change in terms of, you know, if you put something like this on the gable end of a house, you'd obviously need it as well. So it is a structure, and we worked with Dublin City Council and with the arts office there as well. So everybody was on board in terms of what we were proposing, and I suppose what the message of it was as well.
And tell me a little bit about the artist.
Well, we have, I suppose, a couple of artists here. We had Dan Leo, and we had the Access All City artists as well for the two bookends, and then a number of other artists that are in place for the cat coming through the urban area as well between it. So, as I say, a lot of people involved, a lot of collaboration involved. You know, it is fantastic to have it on display for so many people. I mean, thousands of people get to see this every day.
Yeah. And now you're heading off to something totally different. Tell me, what's going to happen today?
Well, we have the opening of Woodbrook Dart Station. So the first darts have already started serving it, but we're going to have a community event there, because as well as the huge development that's happening beside it, you do have the existing community in Shangana. So it's a family fun day. And just, again, welcome the community to the new station, and as well, welcome ourselves to the community as well. We're open, we're here, and looking forward to welcoming you on board.
And as you finish, I see the gates are closing, so it's time for you to go.
Take off
the headphones, and off you go to the dark.
Thanks, William Perry.
Okay. So, Derek, there it is from Barry. Barry is now rushing off, and he's heading off on the dark to Woodbrook.
Well, thanks to Barry Kenny indeed, and good luck with the opening. As I said, this is a specially pre-recorded programme on Sunday, the 10th of August, although you're hearing it at a later date. Now, Terry, you are standing under the fox, so can you give me a pen picture of exactly what it looks like?
Yes, Derek, we're standing here just underneath this fox, and it's beautiful. It's looking up that tunnel, and its ears are pricked, and you can see the tail is parallel to the body. It looks as if it's out hunting, as if it has scented a prey. And although it's very colourful and it's not exactly like what a fox looks like, everybody would recognise it as a fox.
Yes, it's a stylized fox, beautifully coloured, curvy, linear, very lively. It's almost moving. As you're moving in the train, you will see a moving animal at the side. It is beautiful. The colours are extremely bright, much brighter than the real fox would be. But that doesn't matter. This is not a field guide illustration. This is something to evoke the emotions, and it really does that.
It is, absolutely. It looks to me almost like it's a sort of a Japanese anime style. There's sort of geometric shapes and great use of shading in it. Flashes of like quite intense red, which you wouldn't normally see in a fox. They're more orange than red, really, aren't they? But the way it's looking, it looks like it's alert. It looks like it's about to lurch off down in pursuit of prey, right down that tunnel, which is really interesting. And actually, right where we are now, this is prime fox habitat. I imagine at night, many foxes must walk right past this mural. I wonder what they make of it. Do they look up and recognize it as themselves? I think that it's really interesting what the artists have done here, because they've taken the fox, and as you said, Richard, it's a stylized version of it, so it's very much recognizable as a fox, but also there's something cartoonish about it. It's open to a lot of interpretation there, but that leads then to that sort of sense of motion, and then of course it's best seen from the train, so we're standing here looking up at it, but when you're passing on the train it does sort of change perspective, and then it's beside this black cat that's in the tunnel, and that actually looks like it's galloping off down the tunnel as the train moves through and gets to the sparrowhawk at the other end. So it's part of one piece, I suppose, to be seen from the train rather than actually standing beside it.
It's a wise choice, because you know that it's running with you or against you, the train. You're not going to knock it down or anything like that. It's a beautiful picture, very vibrant motion, wonderful.
And it's different when you're going in the different directions, because as Niall says, in one case it's running towards you, and in another case, it's running against you. But when you look at the inside in the tunnel, it's as if it's watching that cat that's running up at you, as if the cat is trying to get away from the hawk at the far end.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe the fox is going to catch the kitten. Mm. I don't know. We'll see.
The thing with it as well is when you look at it here, as we are underneath it now, you see the fox right there from this angle. But when you're on the train, what actually happens is it looks like the fox is perched atop, I don't know what this, it's like a junction box.
Yes,
sort of,
yeah.
Electricity terminal, something like that, that has been painted with sort of, it looks like sticks and logs, sort of, I suppose, a rural kind of scene or nature kind of biodiversity kind of view. But it looks like the fox is actually perched on top of that, about to launch off it. And that's not really too obvious unless you're actually on the train going past. Mm.
Or is the fox is just hiding behind that?
Possibly.
Because we can't actually see the fox's legs.
That's right. It's sort of in that crouched position. Yeah. Looks like it's sprung ready for action, whether that is pursuit of prey, whether that's fear. It certainly captures, though, that sense that we have. When we see foxes, they're very wary.
Yeah.
Even the urban foxes, which are now so used to people, they're wary. You'll see their head turn, you'll see the ears raised. And the ears are up, and it's looking at something, so it's alert for sure.
Well, you remember last week when we were in that garden and we were watching that fox for an hour or so. Mm-hmm. Isn't the position and the gait of this fox, isn't it exactly like what we saw last week?
It reminds me particularly, Terry, of the young fox, the younger of the two last week in Martin's garden, that was looking down at us from that tennis court above the garden. That wariness, the turning the head from side to side, the raising the ears. And then when the larger fox came into the garden and we saw it just a few metres away, just outside that window, exactly like this. The posture is very accurate. So the artists here have done an amazing job of doing something that's recognisably a fox, but getting that sense of motion and also playing around with geometry and with colour and with shadows to do something that's artistically very creative.
Yes, and fox is the thing to put up there, because it is a cultural icon, a wildlife cultural icon. The fox is extremely important culturally, a wonderful animal, and there's a kind of reconciliation going on between ourselves and foxes. We've persecuted them for centuries, poisoned them, trapped them, shot them, hunted them with dogs. Now we're beginning to see the virtues of the fox and accept him. He's one of the first lovable animals to move into the city. He's now loved. He has a dark side to him, which just makes him all the more attractive. He is, of course, Reynard the Fox. He's a kind of sly creature. The famous quote from Shakespeare, which says, "For treason is but trusted like the fox, who ne'er so tame, so cherished and locked up, will have the wild trick of his ancestors." And the fox, of course, is a scheming character, a cunning character.
You're very hard on the fox there, which he's just looking after himself. I mean, if he comes into the garden, what's he looking for? He's looking for food. He's generally not going to do any damage in the garden if you leave out food, from which a lot of people in cities now are doing. And then they can actually just watch it and enjoy it.
He is a complex character that we love. And we love the dark side of him, the Flurry Knox kind of.
Aren't we all complex?
That sort of thing. We like that. I think he's a cute whore, you know, and we love cute whores. We have a dark, cute whore side to all of us, which we try to cover up most of the time. So the fox appeals to this side of us. He's an ideal choice. And he is being accepted in the cities. He seems to be doing better in the summer than he did in the country. Who knows?
Terry, you'll remember last week in Martin's garden, we were watching the fox in the garden there, and it taught me actually that the fox was alert. Because it wasn't a top dog, let's say, in that garden. We thought, first of all, that it was reacting and looking nervous because of us, but it wasn't. It was because of the presence of the badger. And the badger is dominant over the fox in the garden, so it doesn't have it all its own way. And in the urban space too, there are quite a lot of badgers, even in suburban Dublin. And a lot of people don't realise that. They're harder to see than the foxes. They tend to be truly nocturnal coming out like that. But that's, you know, the fox isn't the only, like, urban predator that we get out at night. It was interesting to see how alert it was around the badger, how frightened it was of the badger. You could see that that was causing it more concern than the humans.
And it's not just badgers, but also large cats and dogs, because we've seen that before with cats and foxes. And in most cases that I've seen personally, the fox is the one that will always hang back until the cat has had its feed, and then it'll go in.
See, I think that a cat is a formidable adversary. You wouldn't want to get into too much of a scrap with them. I'd say on average, fox and cats are pretty evenly matched. But it's interesting that, talking of a cat, that black cat that's part of this extended mural going down through the tunnel here at Lansdowne Road Station, is that cat perhaps running away from that fox? There's a sense of motion that's heading down towards the hawk. It's hard to say, but when you're on the train and you see it going past that cat, it's like the cat is galloping along. It's a sense of motion with the flickering of the windows, which is really, really effective.
But isn't the cat running towards the fox? I mean, that's what I saw from it. It's amazing what we see different things from it.
It is that sense of motion happens, and maybe it depends on which way the train is going. Yeah, that would give you the perspective, because I'm usually paying more attention as I'm going from Wicklow into the city, and maybe that's the perspective I get, because the fox is the first thing that I see. If you come from the other direction, the fox is the last thing that you see.
But so you also, when you're coming out of the city, you see that cat and it's galloping. It's getting away from, I thought, the hawk.
Well, there we go. So it's just interesting how it looks, isn't it? It's amazing, the whole setup.
Well, the lovable rogue, the fox, is the great survivor. We had two dogs in this country. We had the wolf and the fox. Now, the wolf is big and strong and fierce and all the rest of it, but how many wolves are there today? They were extinct from the 18th century onwards. But the fox, despite all the persecution, but all everything else, this sly fella is managing to get by, and he is thriving. And that's not true just in Ireland. It's true everywhere. A fox is a great animal, a great icon to put up there. It reminds us of the triumph of intelligence over strength and fierceness.
He's certainly doing very, very well in the city, in the urban and suburban areas in the city. Like, we're very much in urban Dublin here now, and there's foxes out here at night. I know that for a fact. You know that. And all the parks around, we're going to get lots and lots of foxes. So they're certainly doing really, really well. But I think that's down to the people who live in the city, because I think the people now are taking them on board. And I know there was a study done in England a couple of years ago, and it wasn't so much that they were doing better in cities than they were doing in the country. But when they came into the cities, women, females, were more likely to feed and to be nicer to the fox than males were. That's an interesting find.
Yes, and there's a lot of debate around whether people should feed foxes and badgers in their gardens, and this is something that people have been actually mentioning to me since they heard us in Martin's garden last week. The thing with that, of course, is that it isn't good if an animal learns to associate food with humans, but actually when it's done the way Martin's doing it, putting food out in the garden, only a small amount, it would only be a fraction of what that fox or that badger would require in a day, so it's not getting all of its food there by any means. But I don't think that those animals actually associate that food with humans. I think they just think, I've come across this food in the garden. They don't know necessarily that it is Martin as a human who is giving them the food. I don't know that they make quite that connection. We know with things like herring gulls, for example, when they get fed by people deliberately, that can be a dangerous thing, because they associate humans with food and then feel entitled to receive food from those humans and can become quite aggressive. It's not the same with the foxes. We don't see the foxes becoming aggressive towards humans. It's very rare that that happens. And in fact, they tend to maintain that natural fear, even in an urban environment where there are people all around them. You know, if cars are going past, they ignore them. But if someone walks past and shows them any attention or looks towards them, the fox will run.
Do you not think then, when the fox comes into the garden and sees the food, that the fox doesn't associate that food with the person who's put it out?
I can't put myself in the fox's mind, but I wouldn't think so. I don't know. There might be a smell of human scent off it, but there would be all over the garden anyway. I think that they just learn that at a particular time of day, that food is going to be present there as part of their foraging routine, just like they would learn that when they go to a certain area, they'll find blackberries or maybe mice or maybe worms, because they have such a wide diet. And that may be part of it as well. It's the same, I think, that when you have things like peanuts and sunflower seed on your bird table for the blue tits and the robins and the blackbirds and so on. I don't think that they make the connection that a human is putting that there. I think that's just part of their foraging routine and they found the food there.
Well, I would disagree with you because I would think that the food that Martin put out last week or any food that any person puts out is not very natural food. You mentioned earthworms, you mentioned berries, you mentioned things like that. The fox knows that. But here he sees these little food cubes that Martin was putting out or putting out something else. It's not very, very natural and it's there every night. So where is it coming from? Look, the fox looks up. Is it up coming from the trees? No. Looks down. Is it coming from the ground? No. And it's the same with the birds. So when you put out the peanuts, there's no peanut tree around. Peanuts, actually, the nuts are formed underground anyway. But do you not think, because I really think, what do you think, Richard?
Well, I think the fox is extraordinary. Now, if you look at it, if we weren't putting out food, what would it be doing going mainly for is worms. Now, picture it, going out in the morning and looking for worms. The fox goes out and he gets along and he looks for worms and he gets some worms. But what if the number of worms isn't all that great? He gets subsistence but no luxury from eating worms here. So he's got a dilemma. Now, the fox must work out. Am I going to stay here and put up with the humble pie I have? Or am I going to go elsewhere to try and do better? Now that's, and if he goes to someplace better, it mightn't be better. And the time he spends going there, he can't feed. So he has to make an extraordinary calculation. But he does so very successfully. So the fox is all the time sizing up what if and what other. And that's what's going on here. He is a great one for processing information. And he's up to all kinds of shenanigans. And where does shenanigan come from? Shenock. In Irish, probably.
I don't think it takes much intelligence from the fox to know that there's food there for the last week in that garden. Well, there's probably going to be food there tonight.
But you were saying, Terry, I think that the distinction between natural food and, let's say, unnatural food, I don't know that the foxes actually, and the blue tits and the other creatures, actually do make that distinction because it's all they've known all their lives. We saw that younger fox being sort of mentored by the older one. It's taken on this tour. That fox has learned from almost from birth that it can find food there. And also these urban foxes, they're eating leftover bits of burger, they're eating chips, they're eating all sorts of food like that. So it's the opportunism, I think. I don't think they're thinking this isn't something that occurs in nature. I think they're thinking there's food.
Well, I know now that so many people are putting food out for foxes and they just love to sit there like we did last week and just enjoy the moment. It's just like this fox on the wall behind us here. He looks as if he's looking for something. He's looking down that tunnel. Is it food that somebody's left out, or maybe it's a bird, or maybe it's a mouse or something that's on the ground, but he's on its tail?
I think he not only knows there's food, he knows that people watching him is a clue. He likes to be watched by people because that ensures that the food will be there. He's an entertainer. He's performing. Is he performing for the people looking out the window? I've seen them do this and they look at you and they continue eating. They don't run away. So he's made a calculation. Maybe it's good to be watched. It's good to be in the public eye. It is helps. It is a survival strategy. That's a very interesting development in an animal, isn't it?
Richard. It is. And I have to say as well, it's wonderful to see Éireann Éireann celebrating wildlife in this way along the Dart line, because the train is one of the best places to see wildlife. Yeah. Often when people come to Dublin and they want to see birds or marine mammals, or whatever, I say, just get on the Dart. Go the length of the Dart ride and you'll see all sorts of things. I can't think of many other suburban train lines where you have a good chance of seeing porpoises or even dolphins in Killiney Bay, for example. You go past Buddhistown Marsh, as Barry was talking about earlier, and you see all sorts of brent geese and wading birds and shell duck, all these amazing creatures. You have a very good chance of seeing kingfisher there as well. Most of the sightings in Birdwatch Ireland, we get up kingfisher, so people see them on the Dart at Buddhistown or elsewhere.
Of course, it's a nature reserve, train is literally going through it.
Yeah.
Is
it different whether you're coming or going?
I think it is. I don't know about the lads here, but certainly I think it is different, because the first thing you see is the hawk. The urban hawk, as it's referred to. And then as you go through the tunnel and you keep watching on the wall, you see this cat. It's a black cat. And it seems to be going through a garden. And it's running through the garden and for about 100 metres or so until we come out the far end of the tunnel. And there's the fox. And the fox is looking at it. So if you're going on the train into town, you don't see this. You see the cat running at you. Whereas when you're coming out of town, the cat is running with you.
I think it's important to note as well that although we can see the fox quite well from here on Lansdowne Road itself, the hawk you can't really see well at all unless you are on the train.
Yes.
Because it's much more limited access. It's in a restricted area that you can't walk to.
Well, you can see it if you're in the stadium.
If you're in the stadium, that's true.
But is it a real hawk or is it a pretend? I mean, surely is it a sparrowhawk or is it just the artist's impression of a hawk? I mean, what class of a hawk is it?
Oh, it's very recognisably a sparrowhawk. It is an artistic rendition of one, so there's an artistic licence there. It matches very well with the fox, to be honest, that sort of stylized view of it. But clearly, anybody who knows their birds would know that's a sparrowhawk. Mm-hmm. They're definitely the real models for that. And the sparrowhawk is a bird that you find in good numbers now in Dublin City and in other urban areas as well. The sparrowhawk is doing quite well in Ireland. It's the bird of prey most likely to turn up in an urban or suburban garden. And I often see them in the city, just dashing between the trees. They're shy birds. They're ambush hunters, so they hide in the trees to ambush their prey. You don't see them that often, but they are present, and so it's great to see those two predators at either end of this tunnel. I think it works really effectively.
But I think it's a very different style to the fox, isn't it, Niall? Can you describe it, please?
The hawk is in quite a different style, yes, done by the Dublin Artists Alliance, I believe, and it's more realistic, I would say, than the fox is. No less effective for that. There's still a stylized aspect to it in front of a turquoise background, but it's looking sort of intently at you as you go by in the train. It's almost like these beady eyes are staring right at you through the window. It's very effective from that point of view. The barring on the chest of it, it makes it look to me like it's probably a female sparrowhawk. The male's more colourful and they have some more orangey russet on the face and on the chest. So it's a large female sparrowhawk, captured very well. Obviously the artist is very familiar with the posture of this bird. It's standing in a very alert way, looking at the train, as I said, and it's a very striking piece of art. And it's kind of a nice surprise as you're going along in the train. You're not expecting to suddenly encounter this giant bird of prey right beside you. It's very, very effective.
Well, we've got one of your colleagues joining us now, Alan McCarthy, who's in Cork, one of your researchers at Birdwatch Ireland. Hello, Alan, how are you?
Hi, Derek. Not too bad, thanks.
You're familiar with the sparrowhawk, are you not?
Yeah, quite often I would see it just outside the back here at home. Even just the other day, I was sat here in front of the laptop, had the window open, and I heard a load of swallows outside alarm calling, which is obviously, you know, very distinctive and a telltale sign that there's a sparrowhawk around. So I shot to the window and looked outside, and sure enough, there was an adult male sparrowhawk perched on a bush being mobbed by a few swallows. Very, very beautiful bird.
Will the sparrowhawk take swallows? I thought the sparrowhawk took sparrows.
So, yeah, they take a whole variety of passerines, really. So a swallow would be quite a challenging bird for a sparrowhawk to catch, but it wouldn't be beyond their capabilities. So males in particular tend to target smaller prey items, smaller passerines, because they're a lot smaller than the female sparrowhawk and they're a lot more agile as a result. Whereas the female sparrowhawks, they're quite considerably bigger than the males, so they're able to capture larger prey items such as, you know, pigeons and jackdaws, but they wouldn't be as manoeuvrable. So a female sparrowhawk certainly would very much struggle to capture a swallow.
Alan, that's one of the things that those swallows were doing in that alarm call they were making, that mobbing behaviour. They're trying to ruin the hawk's element of surprise. They're ambush hunters, so they rely on that element of surprise, that sneak attack to try and catch their prey. If they had that and they could dash out, then they could conceivably get a swallow. But if the swallows are drawing attention to it, well, that's ruining its chances, so it's better just move off and try its luck elsewhere.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. You could see that the sparrowhawk wasn't very impressed by its cover being blown.
Yeah, and sparrowhawks, people are often surprised to learn, are very at home in the urban environment. In fact, the urban environment is great for many raptors or birds of prey, isn't that right?
It is, yeah, it is. So sparrowhawks have adapted really well to the urban environment. Like, traditionally, they'd be associated with sort of woodland habitats. They're very much a bird of woodlands, but in more recent times, they have adapted to kind of more open farmland, with hedgerows and tree lines, which they use for cover when they're trying to ambush prey, and also then urban environments. So very often when, you know, if you're feeding birds out the garden, you might have a sparrowhawk occasionally visiting your feeders, trying to make use of the prey availability there. But also as well, you know, they are nesting in urban environments. They're not just hunting in urban environments. So very often you would find them nesting in kind of large parks, and also even in kind of large gardens as well. So they have adapted very, very well to the urban environment, as well as, you know, other birds of prey, as you say, such as the peregrine falcon. They're traditionally a cliff nesting species, but they have actually adapted to nest on buildings, which essentially imitate the more natural cliff nesting habitat. So in Cork City, we'd have around two pairs of peregrines nesting in the city, including on St. Finbarr's Cathedral, where we had a camera there this year, and the pair of peregrine falcons managed to fledge one female chick. And as well as that, of course, you know, buzzards are on the increase, and they're now actually nesting within cities and towns nowadays. There's a couple of pairs in Cork City even, nesting, you know, right within the city centre pretty much. So quite a few raptors have adapted to nesting in the urban environment.
I think the city should really suit sparrowhawks. I used to see them wheeling around high up. And what are they doing? They're looking to see where the little birds are. And when they spot a garden with little birds in it, they then come in low, below the radar, hopping over, hedge hopping over all the various hedges, and suddenly they're on the birds. They've come over the hedge unexpectedly and clobber a nice fat sparrow, or even, in the case of the female, a thrush or a starling. So it's a very, the urban, suburban environment should suit them down to the ground. Do you think it does?
It does, yeah, absolutely. Like, the urban environment has so many sort of landscape features within it that it serves as a really good cover for the type of hunting that they implement. So as they're an ambush predator, they sneak up, they'd fly along one side of a hedgerow, and then at the last second they'd cut over and across the hedgerow to sneak up on the prey. So considering that, you know, there's so many gardens and so many buildings in urban environments, it provides the perfect cover for this sort of hunting. Of course, the odd time, I remember my first encounter with the sparrowhawk as a child, unfortunately, was one which crashed into one of our windows at home. It was obviously just after capturing a juvenile chaffinch, and unfortunately it collided with one of the windows at home. So it wasn't its finest moment, let's say. But yeah, they use sort of all these features in the urban environment to actually sneak up on the prey.
One of the most striking things about the mural here at Lansdowne Road is the eyes, that's wonderful stare that the sparrowhawks have, that very intense gaze that they have. Their eyesight is incredibly important for them, isn't it? And incredibly good.
It is, yeah, it is. So some birds of prey would use hearing to actually find and locate their prey. Sparrowhawks use eyesight, so their eyesight is incredibly sharp. And one of the really, really interesting adaptions that they have is that because they're very often flying through woodland and vegetation, they actually have a nictitating membrane, which is essentially like a third eyelid. It's translucent. So when they're flying through vegetation, they're able to close this membrane, which helps protect the eye from little twigs and leaves and branches when they're in pursuit of their prey. So they're really well adapted in terms of their eyesight to utilising it for finding their prey.
And talking actually of that adaptation for woodland as well, one of the big differences you see between another area, between the sparrowhawk and another aerial hunter of birds, the peregrine falcon, is the shape of their wings. The peregrines have long pointed wings, which are designed for speed and sort of an open space. The sparrowhawk has somewhat surprisingly short wings for a bird of prey, rounded tips. That's for agility and dashing between branches and trees.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And their tail is very long as well, in proportion to the rest of the body. And of course, that long tail then helps with that maneuverability. They're able to turn corners incredibly quickly and an incredibly tight radius when they're in pursuit of prey. If you ever see, you know, footage of a sparrowhawk hunting through woodland in slow motion, you can see just how rapidly and how dramatically they're moving their tail in order to navigate through tight branches and whatnot.
In a funny way, it's inverting normal ambush predator behaviour. An ambush predator normally waits in frozen oh, for something to come within reach, and then it jumps out and clobbers it. But the sparrowhawk does it differently. He's an ambush predator, but he comes in at low flight. He comes in, he is ambushing in a different sort of way, an inverted way. It's the prey stays stationary and the predator comes in and clobbers it. It's a pretty interesting development that you get an ambush predator turning the thing on its head. Instead of being lying motionless itself, it does all the moving and the prey lies motionless.
Does indeed, yeah. And if you ever see a sparrowhawk kind of perched up in a tree or in a bush, and if the, you know, there's no birds alarming, it's always worth just waiting and watching the sparrowhawk, because you can be almost guaranteed that it's keeping an eye out for its next meal. And if you are fortunate enough, you will see a dramatic pursuit.
Richard, I mean, I see you're disparaging the poor sparrows. I mean, saying that sparrowhawk doesn't want to be feeding on sparrows. I mean, Matthew, in the Bible, if we go to Matthew, it says in the Gospels, are not two sparrows sold for a farthing, and not one of them shall fall on the ground without your father. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear ye not, therefore. Ye are of more value than many sparrows. So it's nice to be balanced up in the Bible, and that we're more important than many sparrows. But you have traction. You have history in sparrow looking at, as far as I remember. 20 years ago, wasn't it, when you went off to the Natural History Museum in Rotterdam and you saw the remains of the domino sparrow. Now, this sparrow apparently wrecked an attempt on having so many dominoes fall in a place called Leeuwarden. It was supposed the dominoes were all set up. There was over 4 million of them all ready to fall. And 2 or 3 days before the magnificent event, this sparrow got into the place and knocked over something like 23,000 of them. And eventually a hunter from the company had to come and shoot the poor unfortunate bird. And he was now displayed in the Natural History Museum in Rotterdam. Does your memory extend back 20 years, Richard, or am I asking too much of you?
Well, I don't know quite what you want me to do, Anna, but there is a special providence in the fall of a sparrow, says Horatio in Hamlet.
He does indeed,
Hamlet,
yeah.
Says it to,
yeah.
Horatio.
Yes.
So Hamlet, but I mean, we have to qualify that a little. The word sparrow meant any small bird. It didn't necessarily mean this. And in the biblical times, they wouldn't have been ornithologists when the scripture writers and so forth. So a sparrow is simply a small bird. Yes, and the Rotterdam thing was very interesting, I must say. The domino sparrow. And there was another sparrow there as well called the Lord's Sparrow. Now, the Lord's Sparrow, there was a famous Indian bowler, a fast bowler, at Lord's back in the early part of the 20th century. And bowling, he hit a sparrow that was flying by, and the sparrow was killed outright. And that sparrow was stuffed and put in the lobby of the headquarters of the Lord's cricket people. Anyway, that was taken to Rotterdam for the exhibition as well. Mm. So sparrows make funny entrances into the cultural record. They are remarkable little creatures.
We actually made a documentary about that domino sparrow. If you'd like to hear it, we'll put a reference to it on the website notes, and you can listen on podcast. Anyone say something?
I wanted to ask Niall. Niall, you're a well-travelled gent. Have you been to China? I'm sure you've been everywhere. But there was a famine. There was a famine in China in the time of Mao Zedong, because Mao Zedong, that dictator all those years ago, decided that the sparrows in China were eating too much grain, and he encouraged all the people in China to kill the sparrows, and the people did go out and kill them in millions. And as a consequence of this, there was a great famine in China, because the ecological impact of removing something like the sparrow, which wasn't in fact eating all the grain at all, it was keeping the balance of the environment, keeping the balance of the food chains going, ended up with a huge famine, all because of the sparrow.
That is true, and the way that it was carried out was that people all across China, obviously has a massive population and did at the time as well, they would go out literally banging pots and pans, running around chasing the flocks of sparrows, in this case probably what the bird we know is the tree sparrow, that's the common sparrow across most of Asia rather than the house sparrow. It does occur, but the tree sparrow is the common one there. And what happened was they just wouldn't allow these flocks to rest, and sheer exhaustion and fatigue is what killed most of them. And then there was an explosion in the insects that destroyed the crops, and it led to some people think the greatest biggest number of deaths in human history from any particular action. So that's how disastrous that campaign was.
But are sparrows not actually vegetarian? I mean, why would the insects increase? And do sparrows eat insects as well when they're rearing young? Or can you explain a bit more about why sparrows and insects were a contretemps with each other?
Well, the answer to that is yes, they do. So sparrows, particularly as adults, are mainly seed-eating birds. They will eat other foods as well, but they particularly do like to eat seeds. And of course, Mao had seen them in the fields descending onto the crops and eating all of the seeds there, all the wheat and so on, and the rice, and that's why he saw them as enemies. But they do feed a huge number of insect larvae and adult insects as well to their chicks, much higher protein. That's the case of many songbirds that we think of as largely vegetarian. A lot of them actually do feed, the vast majority in fact, feed insect food to their chicks when developing. And we're talking about, you know, millions or billions upon billions of insects that weren't taken out of the population. And that's something we should remember about, you know, when people are talking about the sparrowhawk. It's a predator, of course, and sometimes people do get very upset when they see one coming into their garden, grabbing a greenfinch or sparrow or a blue tit from the feeder. That's not pleasant to see. I do accept that. But we need to realise that almost all birds kill to survive. So those blue tits and those sparrows, they're ending lots of lives as well. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Just hearing another dart approaching the platform there, Niall, as you're talking about the birds feeding.